welcome to The Autograph with me, Susan Madaris. Today I am joined by a satellite from Texas by Professor Terry Anderson, author of the new book, Bush's Wars. We have a lot to talk about, from the recent announcement of U.S. troops withdrawal from Iraq by U.S. President Barack Obama to the root causes of the recent uprisings here in the United States. So do join us. Terry H. Anderson is professor of history at Texas A&M University. A Vietnam veteran, he has taught in Malaysia and Japan and was a Fulbright professor in China and the Mary Ball Washington Professor of American History at University College Dublin. He is the author of numerous articles on the 1960s and the Vietnam War. Author of several books, his latest work is titled Bush's Wars. The books about America's wars in Iraq and Afghanistan could fill a library. However, each explore a narrow slice of a whole. Two wars launched by a single president as part of a single foreign policy. But Anderson examines them together in a single comprehensive overview. Shortly after the terrorist attacks of September 11, 2001, then U.S. President George W. Bush told advisor Karl Rove, "I am here for a reason, and this is how we're going to be judged." Anderson provides this judgment in his sweeping, authoritative account of Bush's war on terror and his twin interventions. Professor Anderson, welcome to The Autograph. Why is it important to examine the two wars of the Bush administration in a single overview?
Because many journalists have written parts of the war. They go into one of the two countries, Afghanistan or Iraq, and they're in there maybe for 6 months, maybe a year. And while they're there, they are in one small part of one of those countries. And they are living usually with the troops or maybe with some Iraqis. You only get one from them. You only get a small snapshot of a big, long war. You have to understand that we've been in Afghanistan ever since 2001, 10 years. This is our longest war. So my aim was to put the whole story together.
The book begins with historical surveys of Iraq and Afghanistan, known respectively as the improbable country and the graveyard of empires, and then examines U.S. policies toward those countries and other nations in the Middle East, from the 1970s to 2000. You know, you put the wars in deep historical context and dedicate a good amount of the book to the origins and problems of establishing the nations of Iraq and Afghanistan. So I guess my question is, why travel so back in time?
It's important because what happens in Iraq? The British put a country together that the Ottomans never had all together, united like that. They had different little areas. One area was Kurd, one area was Sunni, one area was Shia. Then all of a sudden, the British come in after World War I and they put the whole thing together. It was not meant to be together. So fast forward from 1920 to 2005. By 2005, what do we see? We see those three different areas of this one country in a civil war, basically. So they're all fighting with each other. You have to know the historical context of the Sunni versus Shia and the way the Kurds fit in. You have to know how all of that fits to understand why the country would disintegrate just, 6 months after the United States goes in? They're already fighting. Within 1 year, they're tearing their country apart. So if you just start out at 2003 when the war begins in Iraq, then you wouldn't understand, why are they fighting to begin with?
You also examine the numerous pre-war misapprehension by the Bush administration's quote-unquote neocon advisors, which you elaborate on extensively. We read that what they anticipated would happen if the U.S. invaded Iraq proved to be inaccurate. Can you elaborate on that?
The neocons' hero was Ronald Reagan. because they had convinced themselves that Ronald Reagan, quote, won the Cold War. Historians don't agree with that at all, but the Fox News people do. But the point is that they absolutely loved Ronald Reagan because he made, according to them, he made America stand tall. No one. We won the Cold War and no one was going to be against us. And therefore, in the early 1990s, the neocons start to agitate for the idea that we should go after Saddam Hussein. Remember that George Herbert Walker Bush liberated Kuwait. But once he liberated Kuwait, he didn't go all the way to Baghdad. And the neocons always thought that was a huge mistake, that if we would have just gone in, then we would have got rid of another one of our enemies. And as soon as we went in, of course, all of the people of Iraq would be very happy because they would have this monster dictator gone. And the point is that the neocons had convinced themselves that all we had to do was to send our army in. And the result would be that, you remember, they would be throwing flowers, you know? They would just be so happy. They would be waving American flags, all of this stuff. The fact is, they were pretty happy for a couple of weeks, and then they realized, uh-oh, who's in charge of this country? We've been under a brutal dictator for 30 years. Now what? Now what are we going to do? And what did they do? They all started fighting.
You know, former U.S. Secretary of Defense Donald Rumsfeld predicted publicly that the war in Iraq would take, quote, 5 days or 5 weeks or 5 months. U.S. President Barack Obama recently announced the withdrawal of U.S. troops from Iraq. What will the troop withdrawal mean by the Obama administration? Not 5 months or 5 weeks, but 9 years on.
Well, I think Petraeus said it best. David Petraeus said, we don't really have a democracy, we have an Iraqacy. And what that means is that Iraq is a country that knows how to hold elections, but they don't know how to form a government. And so what we've had is Maliki in there, and Maliki won the first election, but the second election he came in second. But it really didn't make any difference because they made a coalition to keep him in power. The interesting thing about it, he's not only the prime minister, his party is not only the prime minister, it's also the Department of Interior and Department of Defense.
Anderson's focus on the Bush administration carries his readers through such events as the terrorist attacks of 9/11, the invasion of Afghanistan, and the siege of Tora Bora. The Axis of Evil speech, the invasion of Iraq and capture of Baghdad, the eruption of insurgency in Iraq. He ranges from RPGs slamming into Abraham tanks to cabinet meetings, vividly portraying both soldiers in the field and such policymakers as Dick Cheney and Condoleezza Rice. Anderson describes the counterinsurgency strategy embodied by the surge in Iraq and the simultaneous revival of the Taliban.
Well, I think the economic problems that we're having today are directly related to the Bush administration. There was never a time in American history that we went to war and then cut taxes. Never. We've never done that. We've always gone to war and asked the American people to pay higher taxes so we could afford a war. The administration was way off on their estimates. They said it was affordable, $50 to $60 billion. And we're over $800 billion now, and economists say that this war is going to at least cost us $1 trillion, and then the veterans are going to cost us another trillion. So this is going to be a $2 trillion war. It's not going to be $50 to $60 billion. And with all of that spending, and it was all deficit spending, with all of that, of course, we got very nervous in 2008. The markets collapsed because the Bush administration also deregulated the banking and Wall Street systems. And with that deregulation, for heaven's sakes, you know, you're always going to have 1% or 2% of those people who are going to try to cheat the system. And that's exactly what they did, selling all those mortgages and all of those new instruments on Wall Street. And so this war is directly related to the economic problems that we have today. And Obama inherited this mess, and he's trying to dig us out of here, and it's slow going. But it was slow going during the Great Depression, too. When you dig a real deep hole like our Great Recession was in 2008, where we're shedding jobs like that, and where we lose 37% the value of the stock market in 2008, 37% of America's retirement wealth on your 401k is gone. Of course, it's directly related to the Bush administration.
You know, many argue that Bush Jr. was waiting to finish his father's foreign policy agenda. What were the differences in the approach of Bush Sr., the father, and George W. Bush?
Bush Sr., remember the word he used to use? Prudent. He was very prudent with foreign policy. And he also had a long lifetime in foreign policy as CIA director and as emissary to China. So he had a lot, and as vice president of the United States, he had a lot of experience in foreign policy. And what he did in Desert Shield, which turned into Desert Storm in 1991, was to get a whole coalition of almost 30 countries fighting to liberate Kuwait. And he also went to the UN and he asked for United Nations approval, meaning that the Desert Storm liberation of Kuwait was legal by international law. And that meant that when we flew in to liberate Kuwait, we had the French beside us, we had the British beside us, we had the Saudis going in with their army. We had this international coalition, and that was very important. And then he was criticized for not going all the way to Baghdad. And what he wrote in his book in 1995 was that if we would have gone on to Baghdad, we would have ruined what we established, a United Nations coalition to liberate Kuwait. That was our mandate, and that's what we wanted to do. The neocons, a few years later, came out and said, oh, this is horrible. That was really foolish. That was, you know, it was ridiculous. You should have gone on and got rid of that horrible dictator, Saddam Hussein. Well, what happens? His son comes in, and his son has the UN mandate to go in after 9/11, after Al-Qaeda attacks us. He has a UN mandate to go in and take out the Taliban from Afghanistan. So that subscribed to international law, and it was a large coalition. Even the Japanese were sending supplies. Okay, so then what happens? Then they start the drums to war in September of 2002 to convince the American public that the next war has to be fought in Iraq. And we can talk about all those reasons later. But can he get a UN mandate for that? No. The United Nations says, no way, we're not going to support this war. We don't see a reason to go to war against Saddam Hussein. And so, therefore, what do? The United States goes to war against Saddam without a UN mandate, which is illegal according to international law.
The Bush administration estimated the war would cost $50 billion to $60 billion to wage. Anderson reports the actual operational tally at $750 billion and rising, not including debt service, replacement of military hardware, and ongoing care for wounded veterans, which added together will more than double that figure. The war in Afghanistan has cost more than $350 billion to wage so far. You know, on page 64 of your book, you write that the administration received numerous warnings of a terrorist attack prior to 9/11, which it chose not to investigate. Why were those threats not a priority to the extent that George Tenet said after the 9/11 attacks, we shouldn't be surprised? We were warned, but didn't take action.
The Bush administration was not particularly interested in a terrorist attack. The Bush administration had other agendas in the first 7 months of its administration. One of the agendas was they were quite interested in the Middle East And they were interested in two aspects. First, they wanted to support the Israeli state and forget about the Palestinians. In other words, we had been the honest broker ever since Richard Nixon, and so we were going to no longer be the honest broker on the Palestinian-Israeli issue. The second thing they were interested in was Iraq, and they had maps out of the Iraqi oil fields and pipelines. In the very first National Security Council meeting, just about 10 days after the inauguration. So they were very concerned about that. They were also concerned about Star Wars, this old Reagan idea that we can shoot a missile and shoot down a missile. Our missile can shoot down another missile. And as a matter of fact, just the day before 9/11, Condi Rice was due to give a speech how we should have to have Star Wars. So they were trying to still sell the old Star Wars package to the American people. Plus, they were interested in getting their domestic agenda passed, No Child Left Behind. So they weren't concerned. And Rumsfeld at the Defense Department didn't think that terrorism was a defense issue at all, as a matter of fact. He thought, well, the CIA, that's up to them. I want nothing to do with it.
In his book, The 60s, Terry Anderson tackles the question of why America experienced the full decade of turmoil and change, whose consequences are still being felt in America today. The author notes how politically, the 60s were the most turbulent decade in American history. I continue our discussion by asking Anderson about the similarities he sees between the uprisings in the 60s and the mass movements today, which has swept across the United States from coast to coast and around the world. In your book, The 60s, you tackle the question of why America experienced the full decade of turmoil and change and demonstrations and so on and so forth back in the 1960s. I guess my question now is if you can elaborate on the similarities and differences that you see with the recent movements going on here from coast to coast across the United States and the movements back then in the 1960s.
Well, one is technology. They've got tremendous technology to get people out in the streets, where back in the 60s we had mimeograph machines, and it took an awful long time to get people out in the streets compared to what it takes now with cell phones. And it's amazing what they can do. These issues, like the Wall Street protests, has really very little to do with the 1960s, except for the fact that Americans in the 1960s were outraged by the amount of violence, the 30-some deaths of civil rights marchers asking for their rights guaranteed by the Constitution. They were outraged by in loco parentis rules and regulations at dormitories, at university campuses across the nation. They were outraged by a war in Vietnam, by the way that women were being discriminated against in this country, eventually by pollution and the rise of the ecology movement. So there were a number of things that they thought that we just have to demonstrate against. And so that is the same with the 99% movement. These people are just outraged that Wall Street basically brought us and a lot of the world economically to our knees, and they're still making $12 million a year. And I mean, they want people held accountable. So in the whole protest idea, Americans are in the 60s and today are still, you know, out on the streets. And they're making a statement. And finally, the Wall Street movement is getting the kind of television time it deserves. I'm happy they're out there.
Professor Terry Anderson, thank you so much for joining us on The Autograph this week. We hope to see you again soon, hopefully in New York City next time.
Thank you, Susan.
And to our viewers, thank you so much for staying with us and watching. Remember, you can always send me your emails to The Autograph at SusanMadaris.com. We're always looking forward to them. You can also follow me on Twitter for latest updates and discussions. Until next week in another show, thank you for watching and goodbye.